And the last thing that I want to say is I am a teacher of English, so expect to be bored shitless. Okay? Right, so yeah, I'm head of year at Whitfield School, which is probably one of Bristol's last comprehensive. Okay, that's quite important, I think, with the rise of the academies and what have you. And what I want to say is, I'm not an expert on Melville by any stretch of the imagination. I just really, really liked him. I read his book and just really warmed him and thought, yeah, he's quite a nice bloke, really. I would have got on with him. I would have chatted to him at the pub. Anyway, this is very much GCSE Melville. This is Melville Light, okay? So, you know, don't get too excited. I'm not a historian. I'm an English teacher. Okay. And if you want the real stuff about Melville, the real sort of historical, political stuff, then you need to read Mariners, Renegades and Castaways, The Story of Herman Melville and the World We Live In, which is by C.L.R. James. He's a black academic, really excellent bloke, wrote loads and loads about Marxism and what have you, and was also really into the democracy of cricket. So any cricketers out there, you know, he's the guy to read. Or also Between the Devil and the Sea, which is what I kind of had a little look at, or the Many-Headed Hydra, which is by Mr. Linebarrow, who I believe is going to be talking here in a bit. So anyway, this is Melville Light. It's a literary interlude, if you like. Anyway, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the story very, very quickly, and I'm going to illustrate the things that I find interesting in the book by some reading. So I'm going to read to you. And I'm going to try and pick out some of the stuff in the book which shows that Melville was committed to rebellion. He was committed to documenting rebellion, and he was revolutionary in my mind, anyway. So I don't know, I don't need to tell you that there's loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of stuff about Wales. So if you want to know about Wales, go to Moby Dick, there's loads in it about that. There's loads in it about all sorts of things, okay? So I'm just giving you like a little minuscule slice, really. Before I sort of launch into the text, I'd like to find out how many of you have read the book. From cover to cover, every single chapter. Okay, right. So a little bit of the story then. I'll tell you the story. About Ishmael, who decides he wants to go to speak because he's miserable. Okay, in fact he's suicidal, okay, he wants to go to sea because he's miserable. He befriends a South Sea Islander called Keekeg. Has anybody heard of him? Keekeg. He boards a whaling ship, captained by Ahab, whose leg has been taken by Moby Dick. They meet a few ships out at sea, who give them some information about the white whale, and they catch a few whales. And then Ahab's obsession with catching this whale takes them across most of the ocean. Okay, and then they all die, apart from Ishmael. Yeah, everybody on the Pequod, which is the boat they go out on, they all die. Okay, apart from Ishmael, who lives to tell the tale. Anyway, just a little bit about Melville now. Melville's father bankruptcy left the family in dire straits, he went to see it about, I think, 18 or 19, quite young. He went to see it quite a young man. He was actually a mutineer. He mutinied and he deserted on a Tahitian island, I believe. So he's a mutineer. He found early fame with his stories that kind of recorded all of his adventures at sea, and then sort of died in literary obscurity, really. But he was committed to democracy. He was committed to democracy. And throughout his work criticised authority from the standpoint of the natural rights of man. His contemporaries were people like Hawthorne and Thoreau, who's a particular favourite of mine, who was writing Civil Disobedience around the time that Melville was hanging out. And Thoreau is thought to be a bit of an environmentalist anarchist, the original environmentalist anarchist. So that's the kind of flavour of the sort of ideas that were going around when he was writing. Anyway, around this time last year, I picked up Moby Dick, as you do in the library, and I thought, well, I should really try and have a go at this as an English teacher, as a classic. I've got to have a go at it. I opened it up, saw the small writing, I thought, too much, too many chaps, not going to bother. But I thought, anyway, I'll have a go at it. So I started it, and this is the first page. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially when my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, and we must all identify with that feeling, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball. With a philosophical flourish, Cato throws himself upon his sword. I quietly take to the ship. There is nothing surprising in this. If they but knew it, almost all men in their degree, sometime or other, cherish very nearly the same feelings towards the ocean with me. Okay, so that's the first. I was immediately hooked from that moment, really. So, how is Moby Dick relevant to a discussion of the revolutionary Atlantic? For a start, it's not the Atlantic. It's the South Pacific he kind of jets off in. But it's a sea to which Melville suggests freedom. Okay, so the sea suggests freedom. Freedom of thought. Freedom of movement, whatever, social freedom. And the vessel, so, presents an opportunity for democracy. Okay, so the vessel is society, and it presents an opportunity for democracy. And what he does is, through close scrutiny of the relationships on board ship, he continually questions hierarchies in race and rank. Okay, so he uses the ship as a place that he can really look at all these differences and question them. Anyway, so my sense of the text, and it's just one of many, 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 many readings of Moby Dick, because there's loads. If you just put Moby Dick into your search engine, loads and loads of stuff will come up. Is that Melville's interested in the way that the ship presents an opportunity for collectivism, which has been picked up. Which is probably picked up by Mr. Langbauer in his labour, and it's a factory and all the rest of it, and it represents an opportunity for collectivism, and that all the men working together for one collective aim is in some way sort of democratic. Okay. Anyway, they are in pursuit of mammon, that must be said, but they're all working together. So it seems revolutionary. Melville's experience of working there. Man in an ethnically diverse crew of sailors makes his youth revolutionary. And via Ishmael, he's continually and brazenly, I think, challenging people's ideas about racial superiority and the rule of white men. Okay? And he begins, when he's talking about the whiteness of the whale, to question the idea of white being good, okay? So the idea that black is bad and white is good. Melville begins to question that very quickly, obviously with the whale and what it does to everybody. But he really goes on, there's a chapter about the whiteness of the whale where he begins by talking about how whiteness is beautiful, how in nature it means something's really important, you know, the pearl, how it gives everything very special qualities. And he goes on and on and on about whiteness and all the rest of it. And then, in a couple of paragraphs, he turns the idea of white meaning good on its head. Okay, so you get an idea of black meaning good instead. If you're thinking the opposite of white meaning good, then black is bad. So he said, not even on our superstitions did we fail to throw the same snowy mantle round our phantoms, all ghosts rising in milk like cub. Yea, while these terrors seize us, let us add that even the king of terrors, when personified by the evangelist, rides on his pallid horse. Therefore, in his other moods, symbolise whatever grand or gracious thing he will by whiteness. No man can deny that in its profoundest idealised significance, it calls up a peculiar apparition to the skull. So he's relentless at challenging these ideas about white over black, captain over crew, and Christian over pagan. Keke, I'm going to talk about Keke now. Keke, who's the South Sea Islander who he befriends, is possibly the top literary pagan savage that you're going to come across, okay? And he's shown to possess the most civilised of personal qualities, okay? People that have read Moby Dick know about Keke and what a lovely bloke he is. He's unflappable, easygoing around white people, and he immediately takes to Ishmael and trusts him, okay, and allows Ishmael to make a choice about the boat that they're going to go on. So this relationship between Ishmael and Keke, which is often looked at in a sexualized way, okay, you talk about the fact that they're lovers and all the rest of it, or the idea that they might have been lovers, is actually revolutionary, okay? The first time that we're introduced to them together is about them sharing a bed, okay? And what happens is, Ishmael books into the spouter inn, and Peter Coffin, the landlord, tells him that if he wants to stay there, then he's going to have to share his bed with a harpooner. Okay? Alright. So he thinks, okay, it's pretty cold out here. Up in Nantucket. So, yeah, I need somewhere to sleep, so that's okay. So, Ishmael goes to his room. He gets into bed. And then he's followed by Keke. Okay? He doesn't know that he's in bed. Okay? So he's surprised when he finds Ishmael in his bed. Anyway. Stammering out something, I knew not what, I rolled away from him against the wall, and then conjured him, whoever or whatever he might be, to keep quiet, and let me get up and light the lamp again. But his guttural responses satisfied me at once, that he had but ill comprehended my meaning. Who the devil you, he at last said, you no speaky, damn me and kinny. And so saying, the lighted tomahawk began flourishing about me in the dark. Landlord, for God's sake! Peter Coffin! Shouted I. Landlord! Watch! Coffin! Angel! Save me! Speaky, Teddy, Booey, Beat You Beat, or Danny, I kill you! Again growled the cannibal, while his horrid flourishings of the tomahawk scattered the hot tobacco ashes about me, till I thought my linen would get on fire. But thank heaven, at that moment, the landlord came into the room, light in hand, and leaping from the bed, I ran up to him. Don't be afraid now. I told you that everything's going to be in a Bristolian accent, I'm afraid. Don't be afraid now, said he, grinning. Keke here wouldn't harm a hair on your head. Stop your grinning, shouted I. And why didn't you tell me that the infernal harpooner was a cannibal? I thought he'd know it. Didn't I tell you he was peddling heads around town? But turn loose again and go to sleep. Keke, look here. You savvy me, I savvy you, this man sleepy you. You savvy? Me savvy plenty, grunted Keke, puffing away at his pipe and sitting up in bed. You get in, he added, motioning to me with his tomahawk, and throwing the clothes to one side. He really did this in not only a civil, but a really kind and charitable way. I stood looking at him a moment. For all his tattooing, he was on the whole a clean, comely-looking cannibal. What's all this fuss I've been making about, thought I to myself. The man's a human being, just as I am. He's just as much reason to fear me as I have to be afraid of him. Better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian. Landlord, said I, Tell him to stash his tomahawk there, or pipe, or whatever you call it. Tell him to stop smoking, in short, and I will turn in with him. But I don't fancy having a man smoking in bed with me. It's dangerous. Besides, I ain't insured. Okay, so that's their first contact, okay? He gets into bed with a cannibal, and actually is quite surprised by what he finds, okay, and is very comfortable with it. And then the next morning, like, very much like a lover, he watches him undress. Meanwhile, I lay quietly eyeing him, having no serious misgivings now, and bent upon narrowly observing so curious a creature. I pay this particular compliment to Kiko because he treated me with so much civility and consideration, while I was guilty of great rudeness, staring at him from the bed and watching his toilette motions, for the time my curiosity getting the better of my breathing. Nevertheless, a man like Kiko you don't see every day. He and his ways are well worth unusual regarding. So even if we choose to sexualise their pairing, we can't deny that what Melville's giving us is a really beautiful, beautifully rendered recording of a biracial relationship. Okay? And even if we're not seeing it as a homosexual relationship, it's quite radical that you're seeing it as a loving relationship between two men. And I think that's quite radical also. Okay? These men are completely committed to each other. And they do become completely committed almost from the first instant. If there lurked any ice of indifference towards me in the pagan's breast, this pleasant, genial smoke we had soon thawed it out and left us croning. He seemed to take to me quite as naturally and unbiddenly as I to him. And when our smoke was over, he pressed his forehead against mine, clasped me round the waist, and said that henceforth we were married, meaning, in his country's phrase, that we were bosom friends. He would gladly die for me, if need should be. Okay, so they're completely committed. And I'm just going to end this bit about Kike and Ishmael with this quote, because I think it's gorgeous, okay? They spend their second night together, and he ends the chapter thus. How it is, I know not, but there is no place like a bed for confidential disclosures between friends. Man and wife, they say, they're open the very bottom of their souls to each other. And some old couples often lie and chat over old times till the early morning. Thus then, in our heart's honeymoon, lay I and Kike, a cosy, loving pair. And you can imagine, you can imagine that the Victorians that would have read this would have been absolutely shocked by the idea of these two men getting into bed together, particularly one of them being a cannibal, and then finding such comfort in each other's company. Anyway, the novel, though, is teeming with character studies, which are pulled from a broad spectrum of trade, religions. You've got Quakers, seamen, islanders, all sorts. Okay, it's really, really, really rich. But I'm going to tell you, because this is important in terms of understanding the management structure of the boat, okay? What you had on board the boat, on board the Pequod, was Ahab, who was captain, and then you've got a first mate, who's called Starbuck, and then the second mate is called Stubb, the third mate is called Flask, and when they go out on their missions, they get down off the Pequod onto their little whaling boats, and each one of the sort of management would have a harpooner. Okay, so Kike was the Starbuck's harpooner, and he was like from the south of the island. Stubb, the second mate, had Tashigo, who was an American Indian, and Flask had Bigu, who's an African. And he described Tashigo thus. Tashigo's long, lean, sable hair, his high cheekbones and black rounding eyes, for an Indian, oriented in their largeness, but Antarctic in their glittering expression. All this sufficiently proclaimed him an inheritor of the unvitiated blood of those proud warrior hunters who, in quest of the great New England moose, had scoured bow in hand the aboriginal forest of the Maine. Okay, then there's the goo, who's a free African. Okay, And this is important because the book was published before the abolition of slavery, okay? But on board, you've got this African who has always been free. He's a free man. This is how the Goo is described. In his youth, the Goo had voluntarily shipped on board of a whaler lying in Lonely Bay on his native coast. The Goo retained all his barbaric virtues, and erect as a giraffe, moved about the decks in all the pomp of 6 feet five in his socks. There was a corporal humility in looking up at him, and a white man standing before him seemed a white flag come to beg truce of a fortress. Okay, so Ishmael is fascinated by the idea of the noble savage, okay? You can tell in his description, he's just waxing lyrical about the way these men move around the ship, the way they look, their habits, and so on and so forth, okay? Readers have rightly been suspicious of this sort of sexualizing of other, okay? Which is probably worth looking at also. But I think that Melville, via Ishmael's gaze, continually champions the pagan and is committed to letting the reader know who is doing the real work on board the ship, and indeed in America. He says, the rest of the crew of the Pequod, after the residue of the Pequod's company, be it said that at the present day, not one in two of the many thousand men before the mast employed in the American whale fishery are Americans born. Nearly pretty much all the officers are. Herein, it is the same with the American whale fishery as with the American army and military and merchant navy and the engineering forces employed in the construction of the American canals and railway routes. Okay, well, I think that that's really, really current, because if you go out to Iraq or any of those war zones, you're going to see that it's the white man that's in control, and it's the African American that's doing the grunt work, the infantry soldier. Okay, well, I think that's really, really pertinent even now. Anyway, Melville's not interested in the leader at all. Okay, Ahab is irrelevant most of the time. He just comes above decks at crucial moments. But he's disconnected from the daily sort of work on board ship. The crewmen spend most of their time engaging in their daily business, working and dealing with immediate tasks at hand. The picture that you get is not different from people's experience of leadership in real life. The workers go about their daily humdrum business, while the people in charge remotely pursue their own schemes. And, like Ahab, steer society into disaster. Now, the differences between the management, if you like, and the crew, I think, are illustrated by the contrasting meal times on board ship. So this is the captain with his crew, with his mates. This is their meal times. They were little children before Ahab. And yet, in Ahab, they're seen not to lurk the smallest social arrogance. With one mind, their intent eyes all fastened upon the old man's knife as he carved the chief dish before him. I do not suppose that for the world they would profane that moment with the slightest observation, even upon so neutral a topic as the weather. No. And when reaching out his knife and fork, between which the slice of beef was locked, Ahab thereby motioned Starbuck's plate towards him. The mate received his meat as though receiving alms, and cut it tenderly, and a little startled if, perchance, the knife grazed against the plate, and chewed it noiselessly, and swallowed it, not without circumspection. So that's the sort of boring, silent, rubbishy mealtime of the management, okay? But compare the stuffy mealtime with the harpooner mealtime. Okay, and they have a right laugh, basically, even if it's at the expense of poor Doughboy, who's the cook, okay? Basically, poor Doughboy is their cook, needs to run around after them, bring them their food. But he seems to embody a typical racist view of fear of difference, okay? And he has a fable-mongering ear about the habits of what he sees as cannibals, okay? So he believes everything that he hears about the harpooner being cannibals. Anyway, in strange contrast to the hardly tolerable constraint and nameless invisible domineerings of the captain's table, was the entire carefree license and ease, the almost frantic democracy of those inferior fellows, the harpooners. While their master, the mate, seems afraid of the sound of the hinges of their own jaws, the harpooners chewed their food with such a relish that there was a report to it. And once, the goon, seized with a sudden humour, assisted Doughboy's memory by snatching them up bodily and thrusting his head into a great empty wooden trencher, while Tashtego, knife in hand, began laying out the circle preliminary to scalping him. Okay, so to heighten Doughboy's hysteria, the harpooner hilariously play on his fear about cannibals, and I think that what Melville's doing is he's allowing these characters, these stereotypes, to send themselves up, okay, in this rendition of their mealtime. But Keekeg, he had a mortal, barbaric smack of the lip in eating, an ugly sound enough. So much so, that the trembling doughboy almost looked to see whether any marks of teeth lurked in his own lean arms. And when he would hear Tashtego singing out for him to produce himself, that his bones might be picked, the simple-witted steward all but shattered the crockery hanging around him in the pantry by his sudden fits of palsy. Alas, doughboy, hard fares the white waiter who waits upon cannibals. Okay, so he's setting up those ideas about cannibalism in the crew. Anyway, so far, I think you probably think I'm giving you a very sort of rosy, cosy, multicultural reading of Moby Dick. But there is a... I mean, Melville himself is a mutineer, okay, he mutinies. And I think that he's always really interested in insurrection, actually. He chips away at authority with the character studies. But it's his telling of the town ho story, okay, it's a little chapter, the town ho story that allows us to fathom his real rebellious zeal, okay. Now, the town ho story is told during a gam. Now a gam is, does anybody know what a gam is, by any chance? Okay, Roger, do you want to tell us what a gam is?
A gam is where I'm not sure if it's just whaling ships, but where two ships meet at sea, because obviously, you know, there's no way of transferring information unless you meet another ship. So they have a gam where they might see each other, they kind of go alongside, and then they cruise transfer off. Transfer and they have a bit of a meeting and pass on mail. Apparently, like, if you wanted to get mail to somebody at sea, like, I mean, I know the people they were at for like 3 years, so you'd actually give letters to other ships in the hope that they might have a gap with that ship and meet somewhere and pass on mail.
Okay, so
it's
like a social meeting, the officers would get together, and the crew would get together, and during this gam, okay, they meet up with this boat, which is called the Town Ho. Okay, when they meet up with the Town Ho, it's being manned by a Polynesian crew. Okay, because they've lost their crew. Most of the crew is deserted in Tahiti. Okay, and the colonel of this mutiny is passed over by the remaining three white Confederates on board the Town Ho. Okay, and they tell Tashtego, who's the American Indian harpooner, and they make him swear to secrecy, okay, he needs to keep this to his chest, because people don't like to know that people have been, you know, trying to get rid of their management. So he tells them that he needs to keep it to his chest, but Tashtego talks in his sleep and then has to sort of spill the beans. Anyway, the mutiny involves First Mate Radney, who is, can only really be described as a redneck, okay, part of the management. And although he's a sailor, Ishmael's very keen for you to know that he's actually like a forest dweller, okay, he's like a redneck or something. Anyway, And it's between him, it starts off between Radley and this fellow called Steelkilt. Okay, that's the name of a hero, if ever I've heard it. Okay, Steelkilt, who's a crewman, and who Ishmael describes as a superior mariner. Okay, he's a lakeman, worked on the lakes and the canals in America. Okay, and you contrast this cowardly first mate with the spirited crewman Steelkilt. Okay, and Steelkilt, again, I mean, he describes all the sort of crew, but he just goes on and on and on about how gorgeous Steelkilt is. You know, he's got this long blonde beard and nostrils like a white charger, and he looks like a prince. You know, he's a beautiful, beautiful man. He's a sort of leader among men, really, a natural leader, Steelkilt. And he compares him with Radley, okay, and this is what he says. Now, as you well know, this is about Radley's management of Steelkilt. Now, as you well know, it is not seldom the case in this conventional world of ours, watery or otherwise, that when a person placed in command over his fellow men finds one of them to be very significantly his superior in general pride of manhood, straight away against that man he conceives an unconquerable dislike and bitterness. And if he has a chance, he will pull down and pulverise that subaltern's tower and make a little piece of dust of it. Okay? So basically, Radley's got it in for Steelkilt because he's good looking, okay, and popular. So Steelkilt is this handsome, strong leader among sailors, a beautiful man. But Radley, the mate, was ugly as a mule, yet as hardy, as stubborn, as malicious. He did not love Steelkilt. And Steelkilt knew it. Anyway, the Tang Ho, the boat, had sprung a small leak, okay, because it was believed to have been stabbed by a swordfish, okay. And as Radley is part owner of the boat, he's making a big fuss of it, okay. This boat is investment, and he's really getting the men at it because he's worried about it. Anyway, Steelkilt, he notices that Radley's getting his knickers in a twist about the leak, and he's working really, really, really hard to clear the deck of water, but he begins to take the piss out of Radley, can't help it. And this is what he says: "Aye, aye, my merry lads, it's a lively leak this. Hold a canic in one of you, and let's have a taste. By the Lord, it's worth bottling. I tell you what, men, old Radley's investment must go for it. He'd best cut away his part of the hull and tow it home. The fact is, boys, that swordfish only began the job. He's come back again with a gang of ship carpenters, swordfish and farfish and whatnot, and the whole posse of them now are hard at work cutting and slashing at the bottom, making improvements, I suppose." Anyway, they continue to try and clear the deck, okay, but Radley's got the answer now, okay, because they're working really hard. Steelkilt is making fun of him, okay, and putting him down. After they finish the work, Radley try and get back at Steelkilt. I'm spending a bit of time on this because it's build up to him kicking off, basically. Steelkilt disses him by getting him to swab the deck. Okay, now he wants him to clean up after a live pig. We've got a pig on board that basically messed the deck, shit all over the place, and he tries to get Steelkilt to clean it up. Steelkilt knows that this is a complete and utter diss, okay? Swabbing the decks, okay, at this point, after he's just spent ages clearing and pumping everything off the deck, you know, because of the leak, it's a real insult, okay? Now, he decides that he's not going to do it, okay? And he says, then it says, but there was more than this. The order about the shovel was almost as plainly meant as stinging salt Steelkilt, as though Radley had spat in his face. Any man who has gone sailor in a whale ship will understand this. And all this, and doubtless much more, the lakeman fully comprehended when the mate uttered his command. Okay, and sort of just going back to what Matey was saying about mutinies and the way that the management treated the sailor, you know, they would have gotten beaten quite a lot by the management for insubordination and disobedience. You know, they would give them a a flat to say they were being told. I'm not sure if it was quite so strong on a whaling ship, but they had to do as they were told, basically. So Radney is cursing him, okay? He's in his face, he's going on and on at him, and he threatens Steelkilt with a hammer. And Steelkilt, he's been holding it down, okay, been sort of ignoring Radney's provocations. He still says that he's not going to do it, okay? But he knows that violence is going to be done on him. And he says, "Mr. Radney, I will not obey you. Take that hammer away or look to yourself." But the predestined mate, coming still closer to him where the legman stood fixed, now shook the heavy hammer within an inch of his teeth, meanwhile repeating a string of insufferable maledictions. Repeating not the thousandth part of an inch, stabbing him in the eye with the unflinching poignard of his glance. Steelkilt, clenching his right hand behind him and creepingly drawing it back, told his persecutor that if the hammer but grazed his cheek, he, Steelkilt, would murder him. Anyway, the hammer does touch his cheek, and Steelkilt just lets go, kicks or smacks him in the face, okay, which is going to be big trouble for him, okay? But as soon as he's done it, okay, he rallies his other followers, okay, because they all kind of know each other because they've been lakemen and all the rest of it. He gets all of his followers, and they take him to the deck, okay? The captain comes out and tells them that they've got to get back to work, tells them to turn to. But knowing that they're going to be beaten for defiance, Steelkilt holds out. Okay, so it goes on and on with Steelkilt trying to hold out against the captain and saying, "Look, you know, I'll do as I'm told if you promise not to beat me." Okay, but the captain won't give in to that. And eventually, Steelkilt is double-crossed by his mate and delivered to the captain. Okay, who flogged him? They flogged them. The three of them left, and they flogged them. And Radney actually flogs Steelkilt. Anyway. There is a good ending, okay? Steelkilt plans to murder Radney, and then they sort of chase the whale, they find Moby Dick, this is how Moby Dick, the news of Moby Dick gets to the Peacock. They chase Moby Dick, and basically Steelkilt arranges that Moby Dick takes Radney in his mouth and plunges into the bottom of the sea, okay? So even the whale is against the bad man on top, okay, takes him to the bottom of the sea. They actually desert, Steelkilt deserts in Tahiti, and I think he gets home on a French ship, okay, and it kind of ends up okay for Steelkilt. But there's no question that he is the hero in this chapter, okay, Steelkilt is the hero. Anyway, Melville is committed to rebellion, I think. The way that he chips at authority, his recording of the mutiny, and so on and so forth, his relationships, or the relationships that he presents between the crew. But what I think really evidences his commitment to documenting rebellion is another story, which I'm going to finish on, which is called Benito Cereno. I don't know if anybody's read that. Okay. Benito Cereno is another story, short story, actually it's quite long, but it's a short story by Melville, and it's in a collection of stories called Billy Budd Sailor. Okay, and I mean, Billy Budd, the type of story, it's a kind of excruciating study of a man's insubordination and his punishment. And the front of the book sort of shows the flogging. Okay, so, you know, again, you can see Melville's fascination with punishment and insurrection and what have you. Anyway, I'm going to go over the story very briefly. It's a very complex story, so bear with me. We've got three characters. The main characters are Captain Delano of the Bachelor's Delight, a Spanish captain, Benito Cereno of the San Dominique, and Babo, a small-boned slave, who is the manservant of Benito Cereno. Okay. Now, the story itself takes place over an afternoon. And Delano, it's through Delano's sort of viewpoint, and he's very different from Ishmael, got to sort of underline this. He's absolutely blinded by racism, okay? He believes that the Spaniards are deceitful and cruel, blacks are unintelligent, okay? As a stunning portrayal of Delano, Melville writes, Captain Delano took to Negroes, not philanthropically, but genially, just as other men to Newfoundland dogs. Okay, so from the very beginning, Melville lets us know that, lets us explore race, Delano's racist perspective, but more importantly, I think, hints at America's underestimation of the African, okay? And the story sort of embodies this. Anyway, this is the story, okay? It's 1799, okay? And whilst harbour near the island of St. Maria near Chile, Captain Delano spots this shabby-looking vessel sailing across the bay and decides he's got to check it out, okay? So his boat is harboured in this bay, the Bachelor's Delight, and he sees the San Dominic sailing across the horizon or whatever. And as it comes closer, he notices that most of the people on the vessel are black. Okay, so he gets on his little boat, on his little whaling boat, the whaling ship, and sort of trucks over to the San Dominique, and finds the captain, who is a pale and distracted Benito Serrano. So he sends his well boat back to the San Dominique to get supplies, and finds out from Serrano that the ship is shabby because he's lost a great deal of his crew to storms and disease. Okay, the blacks on board are all slaves. Okay, and their property is a slave owner who perished during the storm, he says. And Benito Serrano is attended by an extremely faithful African slave named Babo, okay, all the time, just there beside him. Anyway, Serrano and Babo talk privately, okay, and this kind of upsets Delano, and he thinks it's really inappropriate for a captain to be doing such a thing. Especially because after he's talked to him, Serrano comes back and starts to ask Delano about his cargo and his arsenal. He gets up most of the usual, you know. Anyway, he kind of ignores that. He thinks, well, maybe it's because he's a Spaniard, you know, and that's how they go on. Anyway, so he has a little look around the ship, around the San Dominic, and he notices some more sort of odd things. A black slave seems to assault a white man, or a white, and Serrano takes no notice of that and dismisses it. But for everything that Delano sees that sort of makes him uncomfortable, he sees something that appeases his racist sentimentality. So he sees the slave women feeding their babies and the submissive Babu who's kind of, you know, on his master's face, looking after him all the time. Anyway, he didn't feel very happy about it, but, you know. He sees the well boat coming back towards the ship with his supplies, and that kind of cheers him up. And although he's kind of still entertaining some of these suspicions about the boat, he kind of relents, and he decides to attend Serrano's afternoon shave, okay, because his slave's going to shave him as they did every afternoon. And Babu shaves Serrano with care and attentiveness, and this really pleases Delano, and he says, he thinks, there is something in the Negro which, in a peculiar way, fits him for avocations about one's person. Most Negroes are natural valets and hairdressers. However, Serrano squirms under the slave's razor. And again, Delaney thinks, oh God, what a worse, you know. Anyway, he tries to get a private meeting with Serrano, and he says, you know, to talk about the rigging and the food that they supply. And Serrano says no, okay, so that kind of offends him. And so Serrano decides, he senses this change in the wind, and he decides that he's going to pilot the San Dominique back to next to his boat, the Bachelor's Delight, okay. So, you know, he spends the rest of the journey of the boat going back to the Bachelor's Delight, somewhere else on the ship, because he's really, really fed up with Serrano's rudeness. But, you know, as they near the boat, he decides to relent, and Serrano comes out with Babo to say goodbye to Delano. Okay, and Sereno Zanano is really eager to forgive Captain Sereno, and he shakes his hand as he's going across the gangplank from one boat to the other. However, on trying to get his hand away from Sereno, he realises he won't let his hand go. And he's kind of get his hands off him and, you know, get on back on his own boat and all the rest of it. And as he finally releases his hand, Sereno leaps over the gangplank and into Galeno's boat. Now, Bebo, with his dagger, jumps in after Sereno, and Zanano believes that, as a faithful slave who believes his captain's being kidnapped, he's jumping over to save him. But then he realises that actually he's going over to kill him, because all the while he finds out that the blacks are actually in charge of the ship, and that there's been a slave revolt on board ship. And for the whole of the afternoon, Babu has been managing the captain like a puppet master and managing all of their engagements. But Zanano, because he's so underestimated, this African, he doesn't notice it, okay, because of his racism, he can't see what's going on, okay? Anyway, you get this story which some people have read it as an interpretation of the battle between good and evil, okay, and the blacks represent evil, and the whites, who are personified by Zanano, who always tries to do the best in people, he represents good. But what Melville is actually offering is a view of America that thought it could get away with slavery, okay, thought it could get away with it, and it ended up getting burnt, basically. And actually, Babu is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant tactician, you know, and he's sorted it all out, and he has organised the revolt, and, you know, he's been in charge the whole time. So even though at the end of the story you get Delano's racist testimony, through it shines through a heroic attempt at freedom, and I think that Melville is trying to, you know, record that. Even though it's through the view of this racist, what shines through is this attempt at freedom. And I'm just going to finish off by reading. So what happens is you get the beginning of the story, which is closed with all this literary stuff, okay, and then at the end of the story it goes into the court depositions, okay, which is, you know, a document of why, of what happened on board ship. But I'm going to finish up by reading Sereno or Delano's deposition, which I hope you'll see documents this real heroic attempt at freedom and the slave's attempt to get themselves back to Africa. That all the Negro slept on deck as is customary in this navigation, and none more fetter, because the owner, his friend Aranda, told him that they were all tractable. That on the seventh day after leaving port at 3 o'clock in the morning, all the Spaniards being asleep except the two officers on the watch, who were the boatswain, Juan Robles, and the carpenter, Juan Batista, Gayet, and the helmsman and his boy, the Negroes revolted suddenly, wounded dangerously the boatswain and the carpenter, and successively killed 18 men of those who were sleeping upon deck, some with handspikes and hatchets, and others by throwing them alive overboard. After tying them, that of the Spaniards upon deck, they left about 7, as he thinks, alive and tied, to manoeuvre the ship, and 3 or 4 more who hid themselves remained also alive. Although in the act of revolt, the Negroes made themselves masters of the hatchway, 6 or 7 wounded went through it to the cockpit without any hindrance on their part. That during the act of revolt, the mate and another person whose name does not recollect attempted to come up through the hatchway, but being quickly wounded were obliged to return to the cabin. That the deponent resolved at break of day to come up the companionway where the Negro, Babo, was, being the ringleader, and Apple, who assisted him, and having spoken to them, exhorted them to cease committing such atrocities, asking them at the same time what they wanted and intended to do, offering themselves to obey their command. That notwithstanding this, they threw in his presence 3 men, alive and tied, overboard. That they told this opponent to come up, and that they must not kill him, which having done, the Negro Babu asked them whether they were in the seas any Negro countries where they might be carried, and he answered them no. That the Negro Babu afterward told him to carry them to Senegal. or to the neighbouring islands of St Nicholas. And so it goes on, and I just wanted to end on that because I think it's a really clear evidence that, you know, Melville wanted to record revolt, you know, and that was quite a powerful recording of a slave revolt. So anyway, I'm just going to finish on my favourite quote of all from Moby Dick. Well, I think you should finish with Moby Dick. And it's what Cashmere said towards the end of the book, towards the end of the story, where they're, he's up on what's that big sort of thing, the main sail thingy, whatever it is, he's up on the top, and there's a bit of a storm coming on, and he's trying to lash the rigging down, or whatever it is, and I think that these are real words of wisdom, which I sort of tend to live my life by, really. He said, stop that thunder. Plenty too much thunder up here. What's the use of thunder? We don't want thunder. We want rum. Give us a glass of rum.
That was great. Do you want to do any questions?